there was this moment in the single track section where I didn't have the Jeeps following me. I could just be alone. And it was pitch black. I turned all my lights off and I just like took a moment, stared at the stars, breathed deep and was like, I am so lucky to be here and to be doing this right now.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Yeah.
This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show and welcome to our first 2023 race recap episode. This is the Mid-South recap episode. We love having a multifaceted approach to these. It involves typically at least one interview with someone that has an interesting story or played a key role towards the front of the race. This week we have two, one with Kerry Warner. I wanted to chat with him because he and I actually go way back in the mountain bike days, sort of diverged in paths, him going more towards cyclocross, me towards marathon MTB and then gravel. And now we're kind of coming back together and getting to race again. He's in the Lifetime Grand Prix this year. Really interesting guy, been excelling at the sport for a long, long time. So I just wanted to get his take on the gravel scene and see what his take was on the finish. We had a tight finish. He was in that three up sprint for the win. And then also we had Marley Blonsky on, who was this year's DFL winner. Wanted to have her on for pretty obvious reasons. We've had her on for a full length interview a little over a year ago, but I thought it'd be really fun to get her take on the Mid-South weekend as well. We also have a Q&A section where I answer a bunch of your questions in regards to the event and things extending beyond the event too, like my pour over coffee gear setup, all that sort of thing. And then also we have all of your sound bites. Thank you so much for sending so many in. We got tons of submissions. So thanks. It's still my favorite section. I mean, hearing from all of y'all, hearing who you are, where you're from, your impressions of the event, your highs and lows, all that sort of thing. I just love this section of the recap episodes, and I hope all of you listeners will as well. Thank you all so much for listening today, and we will catch you after the show.
Hey, what's up, you guys? This is Malik J. Lemon, and I was the 1,015th rider to finish at Mid-South Gravel this year with a time of 11 hours and 37 minutes. And my experience, it was my own. And I just want to encourage anyone out there listening to say, you can go out there and have your own experience too. And if you don't think you can do it, I think that's all the more reason to try. I gave this race everything I had and it completely kicked my butt. But the thing is, it's going to give back. The experience is going to give back to you tenfold, whatever you put into it. So if you want to go out there and rip it up for 12 miles, 50, or the full 100, go for it. All right, you guys, I'll see you out there.
Hey, Payson, this is Rachel Wills from Whidbey Island, Washington, and soon to be Naples, Italy. 2023 Mid-South Gravel was literally a magic carpet ride. I had the best day out there. I was riding with some really amazing people all day long. I loved how the 150-mile courses connected throughout the day. I loved giving energy to people out there and receiving it back just as much. The course was fantastic. The single track was amazing. Bringing back the Chaise Lounge was so, so, so much fun. I almost teared up as I headed into that lake area. Super thankful for all the volunteers and especially Bobby. That hug at the finish line was a great way to say goodbye to the USA. So congratulations on a great race and we'll keep on listening.
Hey Payson, my name is Tim. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska, home of Gravel Worlds, which you really need to come do one of these years. Experience these rollers that we have in this area, or what we call death by a thousand paper cuts. Yeah, I did the 58 miler this year at Mid-South, did the 100 miler last year. It's a great event. Honestly, I tell friends if I had one event to do every year, it would be Mid-South. You know, a lot of adjectives being thrown around, you know, the vibe, the stoke, they're always high. But, you know, what I truly like most about Mid-South is just how welcoming everyone is, from Bobby all the way down, his crew. Whether you're the seasoned pro or the brand new rider, you know, everyone is treated the same. Everyone is welcomed, and it's a really great event, and I'm lucky to have it within a 6 mile car ride. So my favorite experience this year was actually being in that single track section when you guys passed. I was maybe halfway through and I heard this commotion and turned around and saw you guys roaring up on me. So I quickly got off my bike and couldn't even get the phone out to take a photo. So that was pretty cool to see you leading the charge. And then, of course, finish and find out you got first. So great event. I'll always be there.
My name is Mark Bryson, and I'm from Comstock Park, Michigan. I had a pretty incredible experience racing the Mid-South Gravel this past weekend. It was my third year in a row racing the event and the second year in a row doing the double. I PR'd my 50K run time by about 14 minutes and was able to PR my bike portion of the double by about 50 minutes. So those two things alone right there, just trying to race against myself, always exciting and thrilling to race against other people out there, but sometimes it's just trying to see those incremental improvements, and honestly was blown away by what I was able to do. I had one of the strongest, or how I felt the strongest, out on course on Saturday, one of the best days I've ever had on a bike, without a doubt. And had many issues that almost prevented this ride from happening. Had to get a chain ring swapped out, had to have a quick set of bibs offered up to me to be able to ride, and I'm so happy I was able to.
Hi, my name is Eudora, and I currently live in Albuquerque, New Mexico, but I reside just 30 minutes west of Cortez, Colorado, in a small community called Cajon Mesa, Utah. And over this past weekend, I was able to attend the Mid-South Gravel as one of their Get Here grant recipients. And I just want to say, of all the events I've been to, this is probably by far the most powerful, fun, and transformative bike experience that I've witnessed and gone through. So I'm just grateful for the Mid-South team and their vision and all the hard work that they put into trying to get me there and other recipients. And I think it just goes to show, like, the stoke is what I've learned is present in gravel riding. And I think everyone walked away with their own stories and their own experiences, and that was pretty profound in my books. And I think for me to be able to personally show others on my Instagram page and my team page, Warrior Up, that, you know, how much fun it was. And I think that's what they saw, that, you know, next year I'm going to be coming back with more people than myself. So I'm really excited for 2024, and they just released their new dates not too long ago, so I already marked my calendars, you know, and I hope to see more people there and more people being able to experience the vibe of the Mid-South.
Hi, this is Alan from Massachusetts, and I just flew home in time for a giant nor'easter, a nice late winter storm, but I loved riding through the Oklahoma red dirt. Meeting a lot of great people along the way, getting a hug from Bobby, and meeting one Payson McKelvin by the food trucks at the end of the night. So congrats on a great win. Take care.
Hey, Payson. My name is Jack Biddle, and I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. And this was my first Mid-South and first century. And I had an absolute riot on the bike. The whole event was so well put together. And on top of that, Perry, the halfway point of the race, was where my mom was born. And so getting to see her birthplace on the bike for the first time was really, really special. Yeah, the ride was great. Had a tailwind for actually most of the way because the wind shifted. Mile 51 coming out of Perry was pretty brutal, but the single track at the end was just, it was perfect. I won a little bunch sprint at the end, came across the line at about 35 miles an hour and gave Bobby a big hug with a time right around 7 hours. So yeah, it was phenomenal weekend on the bike. I can't wait for the next one. Cheers.
Hey, Payson. My name's Maydeen Whitmer. I am a big fan of you and the podcast. Congratulations on your win this past weekend. That was super cool to see. For my personal experience, this was actually my first time racing Mid-South, and I raced the 50 mile, which is super fun, super adventurous, super hard, but it was just super exciting to be out in different terrain and different dirt than back home in Michigan. And it was actually my first gravel race outside of Michigan, which was a lot different, but it was so much fun. The community was absolutely amazing, and being with my team Bissell AVG was also made it a very fantastic weekend. Again, congratulations on your win, and love the podcast.
All right, so Kerry Warner, we've known each other a long time. We used to race mountain bikes together quite a bit. You sort of transitioned to cross as your primary focus, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago? Or has it been longer? I feel like we're old all of a sudden.
Yeah, no, yeah, we are. I mean, I'm turning 32 at the end of the month, so.
Yep.
Yeah. But no, I was like 2015, because that was like my first year with Raleigh Clement, and that was when I got on like a first proper like cross team. Yeah.
Cool.
So 7 years.
Yep. And then I saw, so for those that don't know, you've kind of done a bit of everything. You were even on Raleigh for a year or two, I think, which is now Human Powered Health. Did you ever do any races with them, by the way? You did a couple races, right?
No.
No races?
No, I was actually taught. Well, so I guess before the year before Raleigh Clement, I was on Optum, which was Raleigh, which is now Human Powered Health. But I literally got signed to their roster just to be a ghost rider to help lower the median age of the team, because they had a bunch of old dudes like Brad Huff and Jesse Anthony on the team. And so there was like a UCI rule that the median age had to be like whatever it was. So they were like, here, you can have bikes and a kit and kits and stuff. But yeah, and I never got to race, which was unfortunate.
Interesting. Yeah, one of those UCI rules that's clearly super helpful. creating situations like that. But anyway, you've done some of everything. Transitioned to cross, and then along with a few other cross racers, your name popped up on the Grand Prix roster this year. I was chatting with Raylan a couple weeks ago about her motivation to do the Grand Prix.
What'd she say? Was she motivated?
She seemed... I mean, look, cross is definitely still her main focus, obviously. But I think she saw it as... The way she described it is it's a good opportunity to kind of hit two birds with one stone. She feels like she needs to work on her depth a bit to be able to handle a full Euro cross season.
Yeah, that's what I was asking about, because I know like she did the full pull this year and I shut it down after cross nats. So like she had like 2 more months of racing under her belt than I did. So it's kind of curious what her thought was on the lifetime thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's part that, and then part just the obvious, which is that brands want athletes doing it right now, which I assume is kind of similar reasons for you.
Yeah, a couple things. For one, like, Kona, like, they basically that last year were like, we need you guys to kind of shift focus from cross to gravel. And then this year things came together with bike flights for me, so I have a bit of a new kind of job opportunity where like I am getting paid to race for bike flights, and they're covering my all my expenses and stuff to do the lifetime series for them. But then I also like I have this like doing content stuff for them, as well as like I have to be a presence at the expo for these events too, just to like I guess be a pretty face and talk to people about the good word of bicycle shipping.
sounds basically like being a bike racer in North America these days, like what you just described.
Yeah, that's what Russell and I were talking about, like when you and I and Russell and every and like Howie and Keegan, when we were getting into the sport, like how much it's changed, like this idea of being a pro bike racer, like how much it's changed over the last 7 years.
Yeah, it's crazy. But on the other hand, it's nice because you can actually make a real living not being in the World Tour or racing World Cup. There's like a third thing now, is good. All right, let's talk Mid-South. I'm sure you've done gravel races before. Had you done any like higher profile gravel races before this weekend?
Yeah, I did all the BWRs last year.
Okay.
So that was like
all of them. Holy
last
shit!
Last year was kind of my. Yeah, that was kind of my first kind of intro into the gravel world was last year. I think I finished like sixth in the series, which I don't know, not all the fast dudes did the series, especially with the Lifetime last year, but it was kind of it was a good year to like figure it out, kind of like figure out what I needed to work on. And I kind of took the knowledge and experience from last year kind of into the summer or the winter of this year. And like, yeah, tried to work on some things to make Mid-South better, which it worked out. So
totally
think I'm going in the right direction
for sure. Yeah, so all of the other gravel conversation stuff aside, I'm kind of curious about your take on the actual racing dynamics, like what it's like to be in one of these races at the front, how they play out, because you've raced at the highest level of cross, obviously raced plenty of mountain bike world cups, all that sort of thing. Obviously this is quite different. If you had to make some general characterizations, whether it be how much you enjoy it, things that are hard, things that are fun, whatever, what's your impression thus far of racing North American gravel?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, coming from cross where it's like a full-on hour and you're just like, you know, it's like you're doing a lap every 5 minutes, so you really get to know the course and you like really dial in lines, like marginal gains every lap kind of thing. And you're also like battling some, you know, like 3 to 5 people for the front spot all the time, so it's like it is a bit more exciting to race cross, you know. But at the same time, there's like, it's kind of like you can think of gravel as exciting. It's just like a perspective shift to where, like, instead of being like totally super hyper focused for an hour, you've got to like stretch that out over like 6 hours and still maintain like, you know, wherewithal to understand like your positioning, what's coming up on course, because, you know, you're not doing the same lap all the time. Nutrition is so much more of a crucial element than it is in cross. Yeah, and then like flatting too, like that's like just equipment choice, like tire choice, that kind of stuff. It's all just like in cross, tire choice is important, but it's like what's the best grip option in fast. It's, you're not really ever too worried about flatting, and in gravel it's like that's like the number one thing you're worried about.
totally. Yeah. One thing that I have thought is interesting too is how there's people from all different backgrounds coming together and finding themselves at the front of the race. And so the actual group dynamics are super interesting. And I think back to like what you were saying earlier about, you know, 8-10 years ago when we were all racing mountain bikes together and we knew like, okay, Howard's insane uphill. Carrie, like you, super strong descender. Like you get to know kind of each other's strengths. But in gravel, like there's new names crossing over from different disciplines all the time. So I guarantee you, like half the people in our front group didn't know like what your strengths were. Like as you're trying to figure out the race, like they're not familiar yet. And so I think that's been like, cause it's so tactical, right? You're always trying to like figure out how you're going to get an edge, figure out how you're going to get an edge on a specific guy. How have you wrapped your head around that so far? Like, are you paying attention to that, or are you still just sort of figuring things out equipment wise and like getting a flow of things?
No, I think you're right. Like, I think that's probably like the hardest thing for me is to like take these, like, you know, coming off of 1 hour bike races, trying to like adjust into this 6 hour race mode, which like is a challenge in itself physiologically, but also just like, how do I, you know, like in a cross race, I would just be like, okay, this 2 minute section of the course, like I smash on. Mm-hmm. So this is where I'm going to push and make people uncomfortable. But it's like, I have to now like figure out how to play to my strengths versus other people's weaknesses on a course that I might not know or a course that might not suit me super well. And so, yeah, it's cool because like it's almost like every lap is a different, or not every lap, every race is a different puzzle. So I guess that's like one of the cool things is like, I feel like in cross, like you get used to just like the kind of race format, it's really the same, but like, I feel like in gravel, every race is totally different.
Yep.
Always keeping you on your toes kind of thing.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And obviously a lot of that has to do with weather too, because they're a lot more exposed. And last weekend, that was definitely the case. What was your impression of just like a 4.5 hour echelon party?
Dude, I was stoked. I was at, yeah, after the 50 mile mark, I was like, fuck, I was like, what's gonna happen here? Because like there for like 20 minutes we were pretty unorganized, and I was like, man, is it gonna come back together? Like, it's obvious nobody really wants to do anything. But it was cool to see like everybody organize and like just take turns pulling. Nobody was really skipping turns, so that was pretty sweet. I know that won't happen all the time.
Yeah, I was about to say, so that was a relief. That can go one way or the other, and it was super touch and go there for about 20 minutes. And then people kind of like got switched back on and got organized. But
yeah,
it's funny, those dynamics. So one other thing I've sort of noticed is like, this, it would be easy for this to come across wrong, but people coming from different backgrounds, like there's different levels of racecraft also, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
there are some people who, like, when they're feeling good, they're just going to show everybody that they're feeling good.
Yeah.
And they're going to prioritize a result second for whatever reason, like they can't contain themselves. And
yeah,
I think John Borstelman was a pretty good example of this.
I was going to say that, yeah.
Dude, like, the man was super strong, obviously. And
super strong.
I mean, he's a successful racer, good friend of mine. But I kind of wanted to go up to him after the race and be like, dude, what were you doing? Like, that was awesome for the rest of us. Thank you. Made the day more simple. But it's really interesting how different people seem to, even though there's a decent amount on the line at this point, career-wise, results, whatever, it seems like some people just like are riding for different things out there sometimes. And I remember Colin Strickland was this way too. If he felt good, it was full gas from the start, and he was going to worry about the last 10 miles if and when he made it there.
Right.
Is that surprising to you at all? Because like, coming from mountain biking, it's always so coy, you know? Like, even like Keegan, for example, when he was obviously on a day where he was 5% better than everybody else, he was still going to have tactics in the back of his mind and actually make sure that he took advantage of the day.
Yeah, I feel like Keegan was like the kind of guy that like, he's not just going to tow everybody around. He's going to like wait for a specific moment and then just annihilate everybody.
Exactly.
You know, like be a bit more precise about what he was doing. So yeah, I mean, it's not all that surprising. Like, I don't know, like you said, I've done enough racing in different disciplines that people are feeling good. They like to just swing it around, you know, like show it off. And then like, I think also what happens is like, when people do that and other people are just sitting on, they get lured into this sense, this false sense of like, oh, I am making everybody hurt right now. Like, I need to keep doing this, you know?
Yep.
And everybody else is just like, yeah, that's fine. You can keep doing it. Like,
totally,
I'll watch.
Totally. A lot. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm glad he did that. Otherwise, he might have ridden away from us in those last last miles.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about what was going through your head in terms of trying to win that race.
Yeah, you know, coming into Mid-South, I wasn't exactly sure how things were going to go. Like, I've definitely been prioritizing some bigger volume rides and stuff, but these longer efforts is what I was struggling with last year, so I had, like, almost no expectations on myself. I just knew with it being kind of flat and windy that I wanted to stay towards the front to make the selections, and then once I did make the selections, I was just doing my best to, like, pay attention to fueling and make sure I wasn't making dumb mistakes and wasting energy. So I didn't really have much of a strategy until the single track, when I knew, like, after riding with those guys and, like, you know, you make a couple left-hand turns, a couple 90-degree left-hand turns and just, like, gap everybody by 20 feet. And so, like, I knew that there was disparities in the technical ability of our group, and so coming into that single track, I was like, big priority of being towards the front, and I, like, you got in there first, followed by John, and Nico Roche almost edged me out for third coming into the single track, but I knew, like, especially with you being at the front, I knew you were going to push it through there. Like, I knew that was, there was going to be a gap. I didn't know how significant it was going to be. So that was kind of like where my strategy was. And then once we made it out with a bit of a buffer, I was just like, cool, let's keep building on it.
Let's stick it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, yeah, like you said, well, we came in and in like the last 2 miles, we were like kind of shaking our legs out and looking at each other. Yeah. Again, I was just like, and this is probably where I fucked up, like, I was kind of like not surprised with myself, but just like, you know, I didn't have expectations, and mm-hmm. so I didn't really like think this part fully through.
Yeah.
And so I was almost just like already settled with like, cool, whatever happens, like, I'm on the podium, I'm okay with this.
Yep.
And I think I kind of got complacent and wasn't, I didn't pre-ride the finish, so I didn't know what was fucking, I just was looking at a straight line on my Wahoo and just totally botched that. Like, I don't know. It was almost like I was starstruck, you know, like I was like, oh, cool, I'm here. Like,
now
let's see what happens, instead of like actually dictating, like making moves to dictate what should have happened.
For sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
So good on you, I should say, chapeau for the freaking slingshot. You got me for sure. You caught me off guard. I was like, fuck.
Yeah, I feel like with these, like, experience comes into these races a little more than a lot of people think. They, at a certain point, like, especially Leadville, Steamboat, some of those other races, you start to notice there's definitely a formula for them. The ones that have pretty similar courses every year, but. Yeah, it was a fun finish, man. It was good rolling turns with you, and it's weird to it feels like a almost like a parallel universe where a decade on we're racing again, a lot of the same guys together after going off and doing slightly separate things for a handful of years, but it's in a totally new discipline. It's funny how it works.
Honestly, I think that's what I'm most excited about this year. I was just talking to Russell. And I was like, dude, I haven't raced with you and Keegan and Howie and Payson, like all the dudes I grew up mountain biking with. Like, I haven't raced with you guys in like 7 years or more. Yeah. So like, just like really excited to get back out there and like, yeah, just like be on the circuit with the dudes I started racing with.
Hell yeah. Cool. So before I let you go, talk to me quickly about the Grand Prix. So Raylan was, I mean, you sort of already echoed some of what Raylan said about brand interest in the Grand Prix, but are you also seeing this as an opportunity to support your cross season? Do you feel like it works against your cross season?
Yeah, right now, I mean, like, I am fully focused on the Grand Prix, so I'm kind of like, I got a little glimpse of this last year. Like, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing kind of like a magnified version of it this year. But going off of what Ray Lynn was saying, like, you know, coming in to cross season, I've never really felt like I had the volume earlier in the year to like support all of that VO2, like from September through December. And like, you know, now with the Lifetime stuff, we've got a few races in September and October, so I don't really get to like do cross until after that. So it's kind of nice because, yeah, just like do these Lifetime races, focus on it, and hopefully come out of it with just this like huge foundation and base to then really twist the screws come early fall and like ride that into some decent fitness for nationals for cross. So while that is like in the back of my head and I'm excited to see how that goes, just because like I don't know, no matter what, I think like racing cross is just like, it's just my favorite. Like, it's just so fun and exciting and fast and loose. Like, I just really like it.
Yeah, hell yeah.
But yeah,
right on. Are you gonna get over for any Eurocross this coming winter yet, or have you thought about it yet?
I mean, probably not. Just, I mean, I've done that enough times to know, like, unless I'm just absolutely demolishing the American scene, like, I kind of know where I'm going to stack up, you know?
Yep.
And, like, it's an expense financially and just, and probably more so mentally to go over there just because it's, like, totally out of your element. Like, the weather sucks the whole time you're over there.
Totally.
And so I don't know. Yeah, I probably won't, especially like moving forward. It seems like this is the format I'm gonna have like for the next couple of years, like doing these kind of like gravel races. Got to get ready for stuff in the spring, so it kind of makes sense to like shut it down after cross nats and get ready for the next year and whatever challenges are ahead.
For sure. Yeah, I literally cannot imagine wrapping my head around a 7-month Grand Prix and then also a winter, like, yeah. I just don't know. That would be insane. And I mean, Raylan said she's pretty much going to shut it down with 2 Grand Prix to go, it sounds like, which sounds pretty wise.
Yeah, if she's going to target cross, that makes sense. But do they still have that rule about you got to show up to the last Grand Prix to claim any kind of standing?
I think so. Good point. I should maybe remind her of that before she like really.
Yeah, didn't you run into that last year?
Yeah, that's true. I know that rule very, very much firsthand. Cool, man. Okay, so you have a sweet YouTube channel. We didn't really talk about it. We'll talk about it some other time, but you're pretty full gas on YouTube. Said you have a vlog coming up. I know you already have some Mid-South content up there. Is it just your name, Kerry Werner, on YouTube?
Yeah, Kerry Werner Vlog. YouTube/ Kerry Werner Vlog. That's
W-E-R-N-E-R.
Yeah, not Warner. Not Kenny Warner. Kerry Werner.
Love it. All right, well, good luck with Russell's massive 9-hour gravel rides down there in Tucson. And we'll see you at Sea Otter.
Yeah, man. See ya. Thanks for the chat.
Hey, my name is Chewy and I live in Denver, Colorado. This was my 4th year doing the Mid-South 100 and my first year doing it on a single speed. I think the thing that stood out for me this year was just being able to connect with people differently. On a single speed, you're not in a pace line, so you instead get to like see everybody pass you, and then you pass them on hills and do this kind of yo-yo effect, and you get to connect with a lot more people, and you really share this kinship with more folks, particularly folks riding things a little bit different. So more single speed folks you have great conversations with, including tandem people. And it just allowed the race to end at a little bit of a different pace. I still beat last year's time, just under 6 hours and 30 minutes, and it was an awesome event.
Hi, my name is Trent. I am 12 years old. I did the Mid-South 100. My goal was under 9 hours. I did in 7 hours and 44 minutes. My favorite part of the race was the single track because I am a mountain biker. I hope to do Gravel Locos 150 next year.
Hey, Payson.
This is Jackson.
And Brock Simmons. We are brothers, and Jackson just moved down from Canada, and now we're living together, and this was our first bike race together.
It was sweet and beautiful weather.
Jack's first gravel race and the longest one he's done. It was an awesome day. We beat our goal time by about 45 minutes. The wind, I think, turning 180 degrees really helped us, and we got a little bit of tailwind on the way home when I was coming apart pretty bad, and he was still feeling strong enough to pull my sorry soul to the line.
It was a great day. Had a ton of fun. Good to see the community and the gravel scene out there. It's a beautiful community.
Yeah, thank you, Bobby, and thank you everybody who put that event on together, and we're looking forward to big races this year. We'll see you at Unbound.
See you there.
Hi, my name is Lily Kraft, and I'm from Iowa City, Iowa, and this was my first Mid-South. I've been looking forward to this event for a full year, and sometimes when you hype something up for that long, you're worried it's not going to meet your expectations, and this exceeded my wildest dreams. There's something so special about everyone challenging themselves and pushing themselves, but yet supporting each other the entire way. And I really found a ton of people out there to have some wonderful conversations with, to share food with. Shout out to the people at Aid Station 88.9 because that quesadilla saved my freaking life. But I'll definitely be coming back next year because I think energy like this at an event is really unique and special and not something you find everywhere. And also the Bobby hug is totally underrated. I needed that thing so bad at the end. I cried.
Hey, how you doing? My name is Bobby Ellis and I'm from Tulsa, Oklahoma. This race to me is life-saving. In 2012, I was diagnosed with male breast cancer. I felt defeated, needed to get some fight in me. I was a bike commuter, loved bikes, was familiar with the race. I found out they had a 50-miler, so I signed up for the 2017 event. I trained hard, I gained confidence, came across the finish line. I never walked so much, I never pep-talked myself as much. 11 hours to complete 50 miles. I know that's crazy, but it was worth it. In 2020, I fractured ribs, and that's how I find out that I was now a stage 4 incurable cancer fighter. Some days it just feels like a downward spiral. Life has plenty of ups and downs, but there's no up that feels as good all year as March in Stillwater at the Mid-South. The friends, the challenges, the inspiration, it's everywhere, it's contagious. I always find renewed strength for the fight when I'm there. This year did not disappoint, it just gets better and better. I have signed up for this since 2017. And I look forward to next year and as many years as I can get out of this.
Okay, Q&A time. I'm going to try to rip through these a little more efficiently than I have in the past. Certainly spend extra time on ones that are extra interesting or have extra nuance. We had a lot of great questions. Pretty much all of them are ones that were thought-provoking or ones that I actually want to answer, and also pretty diverse. Definitely plenty of stuff about Mid-South, of course, but some broader stuff too. And instead of, like we've done in the past, we're going to just read them, or I'm just going to read them and answer them in the order they came through. We've tried kind of organizing them in the past, categorizing them. I've sort of tried to mentally come up with answers beforehand sometimes, but instead I just took a very quick first glance at these once, and I'm just going to kind of answer them with a gut reaction sort of style instead. I often think that just works better anyway. So the first question is, could you describe your pour-over travel kit setup? And I think this is in reference to last week's episode with Raylan Nuss, where I talked about how she inspired me to travel with a pour-over coffee kit. Basically, it's just a fancier way to make coffee, and once you've tried it, and if good coffee matters to you, you don't really go back, in my experience. For a few years I've traveled with basically Hario-based equipment. That's H-A-R-I-O. I believe they're a Japanese company, so a little scale to measure out your coffee. And basically, you can get into the weeds quickly, but basically you measure out 20 grams of coffee beans, get yourself a nice hand grinder, grind it. Freshly ground is important. Pour it into also a Hario funnel with one of their V60 filters. Put that on your favorite cup. Heat up some water also in a Hario kettle. And then basically you do different pours. And you also weigh the water that you're putting in. And you have a timer going on the scale too. It's all very fancy and scientific, but it tastes amazing. Recently though, when Nicole and I traveled to New Zealand, we were introduced to an easy calf, which is also a pour over style thing, but it makes it super easy. It's kind of hard to describe. I think it's spelled easy I-C-A-F. They're about $50. And you just do one pour. So I've kind of actually gone to that because it basically makes as good a cup of coffee as the fancy funnel and all that sort of thing. But it has, you can use the filtration system basically unlimited time, so you don't have to go through filters, which is nice. Were the roads properly closed off for the sprint finish? Looked pretty sus from the video. So like I said, these questions are kind of going to be all over the map. So prepare to play mental tennis with me, I guess, as we bounce all over the place. The roads were, the busy intersections were controlled for us. There was a big police presence, which was nice, but I understand that that was kind of unique for our finish. Everyone behind us did not have that luxury. One of the trickier parts of Mid-South is that it does start and finish in downtown Stillwater, Oklahoma, which is a university town, pretty big. There are multiple stoplights, stop signs, all that sort of thing. I do think this is one of the few areas that the race could continue to improve. I felt safe ripping through intersections. There was maybe one or two stop signs where we had to slow down, take a good peek, even though the lead vehicle was doing their best. It felt like we wanted to be extra careful for obvious reasons. But yeah, this is a unique aspect of gravel. I think an area where it continues to have room to grow and improve across all events. And Mid-South is certainly one of them. I hope that there isn't, you know, some sort of quantum leap in how seriously this is taken due to an incident. I hope it just continues to improve, and those of us who have the ear of promoters can kind of stay on it and request significantly greater, you know, safety measures taken each and every year. Because obviously it's really important regardless of whether you're at the front of the race or the middle or the back. It doesn't really, I mean, there are scenarios where you're coming into an intersection and it's a slight downhill, and it doesn't really matter whether you're in the front trying to win or you're in a thousandth place going slightly downhill. You know, 20 miles an hour is enough to make for a tricky situation. That's my take. Did you decide in advance to launch from the single track, or was that a spur of the moment thing? Definitely plan to use the single track. My coach Dennis and I talked about that at length. It was just really well positioned to kind of play a pivotal role in the race. I knew I wanted to get in there first, but we also knew we wanted to keep enough powder dry to actually be able to go the distance right after, because we had a feeling that there was going to be, you know, at least 8 riders, maybe even more, going into that section, which means leaving that section, even though it is single track, it was only, you know, 5 minutes long or something. And so gaps were likely to still be small, which means tricky group dynamics coming out the other side. And you need to actually have the energy and gas in the tank to keep a separation solidified and then, you know, stretch it out and improve on those time gaps. So I exited the single track with just a little bit of a time gap. I'm going to say like 3 to 5 seconds on Carey and John Borstelman. And for half a second, I thought, you know what, maybe I just go all in here and see if I can roll it solo. But the way John had been riding that day and the way that I know Carey, you know, Carey is a very strong rider and has been for a long time, I knew it would be a bit of a gamble. And I wasn't exactly sure what the wind direction was doing. So instead, just kind of decide to make them work for it a tiny bit to burn a couple of matches as they close that little gap, and then just roll hard turns. And I had a feeling based on, you know, just sort of the assessment you do of your competition, that I had the freshest legs at that point in the race. And so I had a lot of confidence going into the sprint and kind of the other strategic options that Dennis and I had discussed pre-race. When did you start biking with the goal of becoming pro? Probably when I was like 10. At least that's when I started dreaming about it. I didn't start training, quote unquote, until I was at least 15 or 16. That's when I started focusing more on bike riding as my primary sport, you could say. I played basketball, track and field, and flag football in middle school and high school. But it was actually a little recurring knee injury that coaxed me more towards cycling. And then ultimately, I just totally fell in love when I was about 15 or 16 and didn't look back. What's the main difference between this and last year's training? One takeaway. Great question. Two things come to mind. One, where I did a lot of it and who with. I went to Girona, Spain, and trained with Cole Patton and Braden Lang and our coach, Dennis Van Winden, a lot. And just training with those guys shoulder to shoulder most days, there's a certain level of accountability and work ethic and just the intensity with which you attack every ride and workout that goes up that little bit more rather than riding solo. And since we are all working with the same training philosophy under Dennis, there's a lot of symbiosis there instead of, you know, riding with athletes that maybe have different coaches. So it worked really, really, really well. And then the other thing that was significantly different this year is higher intensity. So a little bit more of what might be called a polarized training philosophy. Lots more sprints, lots more big gear drills, all kinds of fancy stuff. Like, just as an example, starting from a low speed in a huge gear, like 30 RPMs, and then staying seated, accelerating as hard as you possibly can until you get to 90 RPMs over and over. Stuff like that, which is unique. More, I would say, looking for very specific adaptations based on energy systems and just the science of the way the body works, and some slightly more like modern, maybe, theories. Certainly some aspects very different than what I've done in the past, and other aspects, a lot of the bread and butter, similar. But I'm really excited to see how it treats me and the rest of us in the Orange Seal Academy throughout the race season. Your podium shoes were on point. Did you bring that pair specifically for the podium? No, I always travel with a pair or two of my favorite sneakers. The ones I had in Mid-South were some sweet orange and camo Air Force Ones, which I kind of wore day to day, and then a nicer pair of Jordan Ones, and they're the highlight reel colorway, I guess. One of the nicer pairs of shoes I own, for what it's worth. They have all this fancy, like, embossed, like, film reel texturing kind of on the toe. Sort of hard to describe. Anyway, yes, they're sweet. I love them. When do you use tire inserts? Almost always. I would have said to you last year, basically always, except for something like Leadville or Sea Otter or Schwamigan. But then I didn't have my fork set up quite perfectly for Leadville, bottomed it out on the power line descent, and with the tire having nowhere else to go but straight into the edge of the rim, pinched the tire. And that really spelled the end of my bid for a top result at Leadville. And ever since then, I've pretty much decided that I'm going to run inserts in both wheels every race on every bike. For Leadville, I just had one in the back. And especially with something like the Grand Prix, where it's a season-long points chase and every race matters, an eye towards just scoring as many points every round is a philosophy that I will be adhering to. both in terms of how we do the training and bike setup. What was your race plan and how close were you able to stick to it? Honestly, this was one of the very, very few occasions where we had a race plan and basically executed it like down to the meter what we wanted to do. We knew there was going to be crazy crosswind, lots of echelons, and despite the race likely being very hard, there are no real significant climbs, and so we had a feeling bare minimum there'd be a group of 8 to 10 until that single track section, and that anyone that was racing really aggressively or throwing down attacks before then would likely just be burning matches needlessly. Because ultimately, one thing I've learned over the years is when you have competitive fields, the race doesn't get decided until pretty much the last 15-20% of the race, almost every time. And even when a race is hard, there are probably a decent number of people that feel good in the first half of the race. Some will show that they feel good and get excited in the moment and try to pry open gaps, despite what history may say, and others will, you know, stay cool, save energy, and go all in the right moment. And I used to be a rider who would get excited, kind of ride a little bit more flamboyantly in the beginning of races. And, you know, over the years, I've just realized that races get decided late in the race because that's when people are tired. So we just decided to stay cool, help solidify gaps, rotate through, make sure that the lead group stayed cohesive, all that sort of thing, and then just go all in on the single track, leaving the single track and those last 12 miles to the finish. And I also knew that with the single track being pretty tight, it would be hard to force a solo gap, even if someone was significantly stronger. And so once I got the whole shot into the single track, the plan was to basically go at like 80%, enough to pry open some gaps, try to use bike handling also to pry open some little gaps, but keep enough in the tank that out the other side, I'd have legs to be aggressive, stay on the gas, test whoever came with, and just be on the front foot. And then with the finish straight being so long and with a slight grind up, I thought, well, maybe we can pounce. The two options were kind of like pounce early, try to get a gap, and then surf the ripping tailwind that we would have all the way down that finish straight. Or option two would just be trust the sprint. I hate trusting the sprint, even though I had confidence in my sprint against John Borstelman and Kerry Warner, just based on what I'd felt from them as we were rotating in those last few miles. It's still a risk, and you just never know. And so I decided to play it a little more safe and give myself kind of two options, and that's where the sneak attack came into play with about 600 meters to go. I just sort of eased off the back of them a little bit, left about a 15-meter gap to get a running start at it right before the little kicker climb, basically carry as much momentum as I could. And then really the crucial part, I had a feeling that one or both of them could maybe snap closed the gap, but the biggest thing was keeping a steady, even power over the top, grabbing gears over the top, and like continuing to accelerate down the backside. Because it's one thing to go hard up a climb, but to go hard up a little climb over the top and then just continue on the false flat down and get as aero as possible and just trust that the tailwind would make it so there was no draft. That was kind of the real trick. And luckily it worked out. What's in your toolkit? Do you carry a tube? Yes, I carry a tube. I carry tire plugs. I carry multiple CO2s, multi-tool, chain brake. That's typically pretty much it. Historically, great race for you. Any mental speed bumps due to 2022 race? How did it work out? So this is in reference to the fact that in 2022, I crashed out of the Mid-South with about 10 miles to go and broke my collarbone and hand, which obviously threw my season upside down big time. I didn't really have any mental blocks going into this, honestly. I was able to compartmentalize pretty well, I guess.
One thing I will say is, although it was a pretty smooth sailing race, I did have one little incident at about mile 13 right before the big river crossing. Hit a big compression and my handlebars slipped forward, like rotated down. And for about 5 minutes, I was super annoyed and just thinking, are you serious? This string of 2022 bad luck is going to continue into 2023. But I sort of fiddled around with different hand positions and was able to work around it. And once the flow of the race started going again, I was pretty well able to compartmentalize and move beyond it. It did require a little problem solving on the fly, but I think in the scheme of things really affected my race very little. But, you know, a handful of years ago, having had less experience, having had fewer scenarios where things go wrong and you have to, you know, work around little setbacks, it probably would have affected me more. And that's just something you gain over time with experience. And knowing that very, very, very rarely are you going to have a race go perfectly smoothly. Like even the races that go really, really well, probably there's going to be some hiccup along the way. And that's just the nature of off-road racing, pushing bikes at high speed across really rough terrain, especially in gravel racing. But that's really the only moment of quote-unquote adversity, I would say. You seem to love this race. Aside from your result, why is it so good? Great question. I think it is an event that embodies the origins of gravel cycling and gravel racing about as any, as well as about any event out there. It truly is one of the events that celebrates, well, I'll put it this way, Marley Blonsky, who you'll hear from, had a bigger, more excited and boisterous reception, finish line reception, as the dead last finisher than those of us crossing the line for the win did, which I think kind of says it all. There are awesome group rides going on in the days leading up to the event, concerts, a unique beer release. It's just fun. It's so easy to throw, you know, community and inclusion around, because every event to one degree or another strives for that. But in my experience, very, very few, if any, nail it in the way that Mid-South does, because it doesn't feel forced. It feels like what everyone actually wants to be doing rather than checking a box, if that makes sense. And it just feels really good to be part of. And also, winning is awesome, this event. I mean, it's one of the biggest now. I guess they call it one of the gravel monuments, so to speak. And it's an honor to win it for sure. But it's also probably even more so just an honor to be there at the event with everybody. Feels like a big family reunion to kick off the race season. What is it about this race that makes it so good for you? I honestly don't think it's a great race for me. I mean, it is a good race for me, obviously, but it's not from a course standpoint. There are many races that play to my strengths far better. I mean, there are no extended climbs. It's not technically challenging. It's on the shorter side. Those are three things that usually play to my favor: being more technical, being longer, and having longer climbs. I think it's just played into my favor on three occasions and for three different reasons. I mean, the first year, 2019, gravel was just starting to hit this inflection point, but it hadn't really hit the rocket booster in terms of competitiveness. So the field just wasn't as deep. I had a sprint finish with Ted King and Drew Dillman. Definitely a very hard race, but I mean, we stopped at the Chase Lounge and took a photo. We had, I think, like a minute and a half gap with however 20 miles to go or whatever, and pulled over and had our photo op and then continued on. Like, it was just a different level of competition and different style. And I didn't win it by much. I mean, Ted was just a bike length behind. The next year definitely did play to my strengths with the insane mud year we had. Technical skills definitely came into play, just sort of like grit, brawly race where speed, like the big riders who typically would excel on a course like this, didn't have that advantage. The speed was low. You were just always grinding. It felt much more like a long distance mountain bike marathon race. The power numbers from that event totally obliterate anything else I've seen in a gravel race for me personally.
I average in 2020, just for reference, I averaged 35 watts more in 2020 than I did this year. Just crazy. And that was 100% because of the conditions. 6.5 hour race instead of 4.5, despite, you know, the distance being the same. And there were huge gaps in that race. So that was a very different scenario. And then this year, we just had a good plan. And I ended up with two guys who are super, super strong. But I think typically I'm going to have just a little bit of an edge sprint wise. And, you know, John really burned a ton of matches in the first half of the race. He was definitely someone that got very excited with how good he was feeling and seemed very game to just ride the front hard. And that played into carry in my favor as well. And we just had a great plan. Maybe if you run that race again and John and Kerry know what my tactic was going to be, maybe it was going to be a super tight sprint. Maybe even one of them gets the better of me. I don't know. But all 3 years, it's been very different. And I feel very fortunate that it's gone my way three times, but that certainly isn't always the case. A lot of it too is just luck. I've never had a mechanical in this race, and that's unusual. Every year people have mechanicals in this race and all of the other gravel races. Gravel cycling is just so tricky equipment wise and taking care of your equipment and getting through the race unscathed. It's been a charmed one for me, I guess, is the short answer. I'm glad to hear you didn't puncture too. Yeah, true. Me too. Dude, I love the... Oh, this is in reference to this guy's previous question. I sort of read them out of order. Dude, I love the Receptors. I did the Michigan BWR on those last year and plan to use them this spring. Yeah, the Receptor is an awesome tire. I don't think it's super caught on as one of the most popular yet. I'm not sure why it's flown just below the radar, really, but it's this awesome, slick, majority slick kind of file tread with just a bit of cornering knob, just enough cornering knob that, say, in that mile-long single track section in mile 88, I was definitely able to push it in some loose stuff, and the tires would get sliding and then hook up on those corner knobs. But rarely do you actually use the corner knobs unless, like, you're making one of those classic Midwest 90s or you're, you know, pushing single track hard. I love this tire. It's crazy fast, supple, great rubber compound. And yeah, it was the 40 millimeter Maxxis Receptor in EXO 120 TPI, for those that are interested. Can you talk about the decision to ride a 2x setup? I thought you weren't a fan of 2x for gravel. I don't remember saying that. It's entirely possible that I said that in the past. But for events that are high speed like this and where weather conditions, mud, just contamination in general, getting into the drivetrain is not going to play as significant a role at all. I like 2x because the jumps between gears is so small. So all of those micro accelerations, they're not that micro in a race like last weekend. Mega accelerations, both mega and micro accelerations, being able to select the exact gear that you want to be in that optimal cadence to keep your legs fresh was really nice. And then in something like the sprint finish where, you know, trying to accelerate and wind up a bunch of speed quickly, stay on the gas, and then have to grab gears going over the top of a little rise and grab more gears as you go down a long false flat descent with a tailwind, just being able to grab gears quickly and efficiently and have the exact gear to crank out as much power as you possibly can, felt key. And I was so stoked with that 2x setup. I ran, I think it was 48.37 SRAM Red up front and 10.33 cassette in back. If possible, would love, love, love a quick recap from Marley. Hey, it's your lucky day. Keep listening. Nutrition and hydration details. 90 grams an hour, question mark, one bottle an hour. Do you feel like you had that side of things dialed? Yes, and this kind of goes in tandem with another later question, which was, what was your nutrition? How did you only take 5 gels? I didn't only take 5 gels. I just posted a photo of the 5 goo gels that I was taking, but I also had some bars with me and high calorie drink mix. I took 100 grams of carbohydrate per hour, assuming the race would be around 5 hours, not knowing if I would need all of it. And I actually didn't need all of it. I ended up, It ended up being like 90 grams of carb an hour. And yes, about one tall bottle per hour. And it worked out great. I really liked it. No complaints, never felt any sort of bonk or dip in energy or anything like that. Seems like this year everyone is using those titanium cages. Why is that? Haven't noticed that. There's an awesome, awesome company out of Durango called King Cage. That's sort of like the gold standard in handmade titanium bottle cages. I've used them for a long, long time. They are as light as any carbon cage, but they're metal, and so you can bend them to hold your bottles very tightly, which is super key for gravel riding and racing. I've just had so much luck with these cages over the years, and use them on all my bikes. Not sponsored. Shout out King Cage of Durango. Considering you're a big guy, what percentage of the racing time are you trying to remain in a narrow position? I don't really consider myself a big guy per se. I guess it's all relative. I'm tall for sure, 6'1" plus, but typically under 150 pounds during race season. So I guess it depends on your definition of big. But in terms of aero-ness, definitely skinny, narrow, but I am tall. So yeah, staying aero is certainly key. In my experience, getting a bike setup that allows you to be aero as possible while also being powerful and comfortable is key for gravel racing. It doesn't really matter how aero you are if your back starts to hurt or you're not able to put out as much power. I don't know. I guess it's not really something I think about too much other than having a good bike setup. I angle my hoods in just a tiny bit. I run a pretty low front end, I guess. Work on flexibility so that I can have a nice tight hip angle, which helps with aero, obviously. Not riding on the tops of your bars as much or something when you're in the wind. Easy stuff like that. What went through your mind when you launched that long ass sprint? Ballsy. I wasn't thinking too much. You're sort of in the moment, a lot of adrenaline. I do remember thinking, whoa, feels like John knew this was coming. He's super close to my wheel, but I actually had Dennis's voice in my head who at one point said to me, once you launch like that, when it's that close to the finish, you just have to commit. You just can't second guess for a second. And it did cross my mind. I was like, ooh, what if I just sat up, rested for 10 seconds and then just went for a traditional 200 meter sprint. But I just had a lot of faith in the fact that we had a 15 plus mile an hour tailwind. And so even if John did happen to get back in the wheel, there's going to be virtually no draft. And just focused all my mental energy on pedaling as hard as I could, keeping even tension on the pedals and just getting as aero as possible, just tucking the elbows in, getting low, and just being as efficient as possible. Because in that scenario, it's literally just a mad dash. Who can maintain like 0.1 miles per hour more? And eventually the person behind you is going to give up. And that happened with a couple hundred meters to go or whatever. But it was touch and go. John was hella strong, y'all. Kept it very exciting, without a doubt. How stoked were you to win after last year? Very stoked, but it felt more like relief after how rough last year was, in terms of luck. I mean that in terms of the whole season, not just Mid-South. I had so many mechanicals, illness, broken bones. It just felt like it would never end at some points. And so to get that monkey off my back and have an early season success was awesome. Certainly helped the morale and the confidence for sure. It seemed like you were very patient during the race. Was that part of your strategy? Yeah, I sort of talked about this. It was certainly part of the strategy, but it's also, I feel like, just kind of basic racecraft. It's interesting to me how much, and Carrie and I talk about this a little bit, there's a huge variation in how people like to race gravel races at this point and just like the level of racecraft to an extent or how much folks worry about it. There's definitely still an element now and then. It's no secret that John raced very aggressively. This isn't a direct like critique of him, because he whittled the group down big time and was a, you know, very much an animator in the first half of the race, and it was really impressive how strong he was. And he's by far not the only person that will race this way now and then, but I don't always quite understand the goal there, because in all of my years of racing, events like this or the Leadville 100, just longer events where group tactics and group dynamics really decide things, there have been two times that I've seen being really aggressive early like that work. And it wasn't even until the halfway point. The two times are Keegan Swenson last year at the Leadville 100 when he rode away on Columbine and then rode the entire second half of the race solo. And he completely on a different level that day. Like, he was so superior to everybody. And he was going for a course record, so he kind of had to, that it really worked for him there, obviously. But it's also worth noting that he didn't launch until 3.5 hours into a 6-hour race. Like, that's still over halfway. The other occasion was Colin Strickland in 2019 at Unbound. And that was kind of a similar situation. Like, there were very specific reasons for it, and the dynamics were so different. It was really hot, and his heat acclimation was definitely superior. It was incredibly long, the event, and he was the only one that had done his homework and knew that there was going to be a wind switch and there was going to be a ripping tailwind for the last 60 miles. And so when he sensed at the halfway point at mile 100 that he was just head and shoulders above everyone that day, he took the moment. And he historically raced very aggressively like that, often to his detriment. But on that day, it was perfect. And, you know, one of the most iconic wins in the history of this, of gravel racing, you know. But those are the only two occasions where I've seen being very aggressive in the first, like at starting at the halfway point of an event, has worked in someone's favor. And it's also worth noting that that was at the halfway point. So all of that to say, bike racing is usually decided towards the end. And so there's a big difference for me between like racing negatively and disrupting a rotation, which we've talked about on the podcast before, and like slowing down the race and just going completely berserker mode and like trying to ride everyone off your wheel. There's a middle ground there of just cooperating with the group and like solidifying gaps and ticking off the miles and conserving energy while still keeping the momentum of your group. And, you know, people have different racing styles and different strengths and weaknesses and, I guess, different things they want to get out of the race sometimes. But certainly my tactic was to, like this person said, be patient and wait for that one moment where I felt like I could get an edge. Do you ever feel, this is a related question from a different person, do you ever feel results be damned and just have fun? Forget the W and enjoy the ride. Yeah. Weeknight group rides or super early season races like we did in Girona, Spain back in February, practice races or races that you're doing for fitness. I certainly enjoy throwing caution to the wind and experimenting, like how far out can you go? And those events, you know, riding with that sort of style can be good practice and excellent training. But for an event like Mid-South, where there's media coverage and it's a high profile event and I have, you know, bonuses from sponsors for winning, my goal is going to be to win, not to throw caution to the wind and just like ride like a maniac, at all phases. One thing I will say is that there are, and Nicole just reminded me of this, there are scenarios where I want to test myself physically in a very, very, very hard way that it are not traditional races. And that's like the Crossing Iceland mission we did or Crossing Tasmania this past November. The film is coming out in Sea Otter that documents that. That's like a obviously a very different mission. It's not a competitive thing as much. It's just a test of will and ability and like seeing just how deep the fitness goes. But obviously those aren't traditional races. What kinds of mental battles did you face during the race? Mile 51 was tough. Cheers. I don't actually remember what was at mile 51, but I certainly believe you. There were some nasty steep rollers out there and tricky, rough, soft sections. You know, the surface this year was not always fast per se. I didn't face too many mental battles during the race. This one went really smoothly. You know, almost formulaic in a way. So I was fortunate. That's certainly not typically the case. That is very unusual. So I tried to enjoy that in the moment as things kept going our way. Echo versus Abel. Why the Echo? The Echo is just super quick. It's so aero, you know, full internal cable routing. It's got snappier, more road style handling, which is great for fast sprint finishes, which I had a very strong suspicion would be the case this year and is often the case with Midwestern style gravel events. These days, they almost always end in sprint finishes of some kind or another. And the Echo just has that slight edge when it comes to aerodynamics and top speed capability. The Able is amazing when it's a little bit more rough and tumble, when you need a bit more tire clearance, all that sort of thing, when handling is going to be a little bit more of the emphasis. How did you feel using the Echo this year and the Able last year? Similar question. I would say the biggest thing is I probably would have used the Echo last year if I'd had one. We just didn't have it built up yet. What happened to the single track section? Kind of went over this, but big fight for position, got in there first. Oh, one thing I didn't mention is there was a lot of 50 miler traffic in there. So it was a tricky balance of trying to stay on the gas and keep some momentum while also being polite to folks, and breathing kind of hard, you know, being breathless and saying, excuse me, on your left. Okay. Thank you. That was a tricky thing, but I think we handled it pretty well. And some folks came up to us after the fact and, said it was fun seeing us come by and cheering us on, and that we managed to pass politely, which is always a win. Easier said than done sometimes. But yeah, overall, it was, like I said, it was just about keeping some momentum through there, trying to go hard enough to force some gaps, but not so hard that you burned all your matches with still 12 miles of rolling terrain to the finish afterward. How many times did you recon or ride through that single track sector? Just once. After riding it once, I could tell that, you know, it was tight and twisty enough that there was going to be a little bit of a speed limit on it. And the biggest thing was just going to be getting position into it. So I actually did pre-ride or stopped and really looked and assessed at the 300 meters before the hole shot into the single track, knowing exactly where I would want to move up, get in position, and then try to solidify, hopefully, a hole shot into there. What were your go-to data screens on your Garmin and why? Great question. Love this question. I had time. I had distance. Those are two things that help guide, obviously, pacing, tactics, but also fueling. I also have a 30-minute prompt set in there. So every 30 minutes, a little thing pops up on the screen. It says fueling reminder or something like that. So I just know to eat every 30 minutes. I had speed on there because it's helpful to know sometimes, you know, launching an attack when the group is sitting on 30 plus miles an hour isn't super brilliant or effective typically. So sometimes it's nice to just have one eye on how fast are we actually going. You know, there's a big difference between attacking when the group's going 26 versus 31. Heading north, south, east, west. And this was because of wind direction. I paid attention to this probably more than any other data point on my Garmin. Is it about to be crosswind? Is it about to be headwind? Is it about to be tailwind? This was super crucial for positioning and conserving energy. I had power on there too, but never really looked at it. And I think cadence, just to, as a reminder to keep cadence high, because that conserves energy too. It's also worth noting, though, that other than the heading and the navigation, I'm not really paying attention to any of these numbers too much, just because you have to pay attention to the dynamics of the race so much. Mostly it's stuff I look at after the fact. Do you wish you could have gotten a photo on the Shea Lounge? Man, I didn't even see the lounge this year, if I'm honest. I love the photo with Ted Dillman and I from 2019. It's a memory that I hold near and dear. It's a great great element of the race, and I hope many people took advantage of it. But I got my lounge photo in 2019, and it's good for now. Did the warmer weather change your nutrition hydration strategy? Yeah, it did a bit. Kept those bottles nice and icy cold. Yeah, that's about it. Just a little more emphasis on hydration, I guess. Last two questions. What's your advice strategy on nutrition during a gravel race of this distance? It's pretty much the same for all for me. Once the race gets to be 3 hours or more, it's all kind of the same in my mind, which is shoot for 80 to 100 grams. Again, this is specific to me. You should definitely experiment in training for what works for you. But for me, it's 80 to 100 grams of carbs per hour and about a bottle an hour unless it's abnormally hot and then you need to up that hydration. It's helpful to, you know, get some ice socks going, different cooling strategies, all that sort of thing. But at a basic level, for me, it's about diversity. So the longer the race, the more different kinds of things and different kinds of ways you want to be able to get that carbohydrate and those calories into your system, just because keeping it fresh, in my experience, is helpful for actually wanting to eat and just staying consistent. Like I said, for me, it's 80 to 100 grams of carb an hour and just sipping early and often on the hydration front. Consistency is key. All right. Thanks, everyone, for all the questions. We'll do another one of these following the Sea Otter Classic. Marley Blonsky, second time on the podcast. For those who missed it, we did a full-length pod last year?
Yeah, it was last January.
So a little over a year now. Jeez, time flies. This one will be different. This is not like introducing you to our audience and all that sort of thing and talking about your background as much. For those that missed that, I highly recommend you go back and listen to it. It was a popular episode for sure. But this one, we have a specific topic for, and that is the fact that you're now DFL course record holder at Mid-South. No,
fastest
I'm kidding.
Fastest DFL course record holder.
I'm kidding. But I loved that post that you put. It's awesome. It's awesome. And it is true, because I remember, so we were just laid out, like trying to recover from the race, and I was kind of keeping an eye on time, and I didn't know who the DFL winner was going to be for Mid-South, but I was kind of like, you know, really? Okay, so we'll get into that. We'll get into that. But I was kind of like, okay, you know, I really want to go over there. We've got time, like... Usually it's like midnight, 1 a.m. when they roll in. And if I'm still awake, I'm going to be there. And then all of a sudden we just hear, it's like 10. I don't remember what time it was. 10, 10:30. What time was it when you rolled in?
Yeah, it was about 10:30.
Yeah. And I was like, whoa, that was a really big cheer. I think that person might have been super ahead of schedule. I wonder who it was. And it was you.
I had the best day on my bike. Everybody's like, oh, was it so hard? And like, I mean, yeah, 100 miles, anytime you ride that, it's hard. But I had, like, literally the best time out there. I don't know, I was fully prepared to be out there for 12 to 14 hours. And that's exactly how long it took. So there were no surprises on my day, except being DFL. Because I didn't think I was going that slow. Like, no mechanicals, no big issues.
Tell me why it was such an awesome day.
My body was feeling good. So I had knee surgery in October. I had my meniscus scoped out for a tear that I had gotten last year. And so this was my longest ride since July of last year. I'd done a couple like 30-mile mm-hmm. training rides. And every time I'd done that, like my body just hurt. So going into Mid-South, I had signed up for the 100 and I was like planning to back down to the 50. I was just like, I just got over bronchitis. My head just wasn't in the space to do 100. And then went to the rider meeting. I don't know if you were there. But dang, Bobby Wintle, he is a very convincing man. And I actually remembered a conversation we had in Bentonville a couple months ago, just talking about how much he believed in my ability to do the 100 and how much he wanted to see me do the 100. And so I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to do it. I have enough food. The weather is going to be perfect. I'm just going to go for it. And I knew that the courses overlapped at certain places. So if I needed to bail, I could. But I just went into it with the mentality of like, I literally have all day to ride my bike. That's what I'm going to do. So I don't know. Just the weather was great. The support was great. My body felt good. My bike felt good. And everything kind of went to plan.
Wow. So, you didn't have a solidified plan to do the 100 until the night before at the riders meeting. That's incredible.
Yeah. I had actually switched my registration to the 50 during check-in. And then Bobby convinced me and I was like, yeah, I think I can ride 100 miles. What could go wrong?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so awesome. And honestly, that makes it even more impressive because knowing that you have those bailout points and not taking advantage of them, that's hard mentally. Like being given an out in the middle of a tough thing, it's hard not to, you know, take that route literally and figuratively.
Yeah, it was funny. There was, I forget exactly what mile it was at, but basically you came to a point where there was a sign that said no vehicles allowed, and the 50 turned to the right and the 100 kept going. And I had been kind of yo-yoing with this guy all day, Raphael, from Minneapolis. And he was like, do you want to just quit? I was like, no, like we're in this for the whole thing. And he did turn at that point. And I was a little sad because he was like, I didn't realize we were the back of the pack at that point. But he was my riding buddy and we were just cruising along, having a good time. And then he was gone. And so I was all alone for the rest of the day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So one thing that Mid-South sets the standard, in my opinion, in terms of a gravel cycling event in a lot of ways. But one of the ways that I think they really exceed expectations or just really set the standard is their celebration of the entire field. And a lot of people talk about that for various gravel events, but there isn't always like you get anecdotes here and there, but there isn't necessarily a way to quantify, like everyone is celebrated in the same way, you know, like that's a hard thing to quantify. Unless it's Mid-South where I feel like, does Bobby miss anyone with his hug at the end? I don't think he misses anyone. And everyone gets this huge bear hug. But the one sort of like data point that really solidified it for me is that your welcome reception at the finish in terms of sheer number of people and like hype was like 10x what we got sprinting for the win. I'm serious. Like the photos are out of control.
That's because everybody's still on the course when you're finishing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But it was just
maybe,
like,
maybe
it was such an epic party. There's a good chance. But
I'm totally joking. I'm joking, Payson.
There's a good chance. But it was like a party for the ages at the finish you came across.
It was overwhelming. So I think the Jeeps caught me after the Chamois Butter aid station at Mount Butter. There were two folks there with me. One of them quit. Her body just like wasn't cooperating. And so her riding partner, we rode together for a while and we were kind of yo-yoing and the Jeeps would catch us and then I would get out in front of him and then he would get out in front of me. And so really until about mile 77 when he quit, which I really don't understand that. Like we got to a turn and he was just like, I'm done. I got everything I needed to out of today. And I was just like, what are you talking about? Like,
you're so
you know
close.
What's about to happen? And so I didn't, it really only hit me at that point of like, oh God, I know what this DFL celebration looks like and it's about to happen for me. So I had like 30 miles to kind of get in the mindset of, here we go. This is what's about to happen. And it was pretty incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, all of that said, as fun as I'm sure it was in some regards, it can be a bit of a culture shock when you're out there. Cause you were out there for, I think, 12-ish hours, a little over 12 hours, which physically and mentally is a big challenge. And you really get in your head. Like it's impossible that you don't. It's just a big challenging task. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but everyone I've ever talked to about a big effort like that, you sort of have to withdraw mentally a little bit and, you know,
dig deep, like mentally. That's, I think, what it comes down to. And so to have that so juxtaposed just in an instant with the most socially oriented explosion of interaction and joy is like a big sharp contrast.
It is. Especially
was that awkward at all or hard? Like, what was it like to switch worlds like that in an instant?
I mean, I feel grateful because, you know, those last 30 miles, it was kind of fun. It was like a rolling parade. We kept picking up support jeeps along the way who had been providing course support. So I kind of had time to prepare and think about, you know, what do I want to take from this moment? How am I feeling? And that's one of my goals for this year, is just to be more intentional. I put up a post a couple weeks ago on Instagram of just kind of feeling numb to everything. And so I'm really trying to focus on the good feelings and the bad feelings. And there was this moment in the single track section where I didn't have the jeeps following me. I could just be alone, and it was pitch black. I turned all my lights off and I just like took a moment, stared at the stars, breathed deep, and was like, I am so lucky to be here and to be doing this right now. And so I think just being really intentional in my head of like, this is what's about to happen. I should relish it. This is really special. It allowed me to kind of enjoy it and be okay with being sprayed with champagne. I basically stopped drinking within the past year. But I like had a gulp of champagne and it was delicious and was able to just fully enjoy the chaos.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. I'm so glad that you had the awareness to take that moment to soak in the moment, because it's so easy to just be focused on forward progress and be thinking about the finish line.
Totally.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I mean, I will say, like, you know, you were talking about kind of withdrawing in your own brain on these long rides, these long efforts. But that's honestly part of the reason why I go out there, is to reconnect. I feel like my brain is often going like a million miles a minute of trying to keep everything coordinated and doing all these really cool projects. And when I'm out on those long rides and all I have to do is ride my bike and feed myself and keep drinking water, I am allowed to kind of, my brain opens up and I can process through some of those things that have just been hidden away. So that's why I do these stupidly long rides.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's interesting you mentioned that you've pretty well stopped drinking over the last 12 months, because Nicole and I actually have as well. And it was a lot easier than I expected.
This was like my first big event that I managed to like not really drink at. And it's amazing how much better my body felt afterwards. Like, recovery was fine. People are like, are you destroyed? Like, no, I feel good.
Yeah. And it's such a bummer because, in a way, because I love a good drink. I love a nice cocktail, good bottle of wine, whatever it is. But it is not good for you. And just anecdotally, the things Nicole and I have noticed since we kind of quit cold turkey January 1st, it's pretty wild. And probably right at the top is just how much better you feel the next morning after a hard bike ride or race. Like, it is night and day. It is wild.
Yeah, totally.
One thing this is a little bit of a tangent. We won't spend too much time on it, but was it maybe why did you decide to quit drinking? And how challenging has it been? Because I know Bentonville is a good times town. You know, it's a little bit of a party zone, and there's always something going on. There's always events going on. Someone's always hitting you up, you know, to go grab a beverage somewhere at one of the many awesome establishments. What's that been like?
Yeah. So, I mean, the why was exactly what you said. It just wasn't doing me any favors. I was waking up hungover after one beer, and really just, it was impacting my sleep. It was impacting all sorts of things. So it was a pretty easy decision to give it up. I will say dating has been hard, because everybody just wants to, it's so easy to go grab a drink, for a first date. There's also some alcoholism in my family, and I could see myself like very easily going down that path, especially in the world that we live in. You know, you go to a cyclocross race and there's unlimited beer. You go to a gravel race and it's just like, you could, you know, drink your way to each aid station. And so in Bentonville, it hasn't been too bad. A lot of places have really good non-alcoholic options. And thankfully, I really enjoy fizzy water. So that's always a good choice. But I will say I have like less patience and tolerance for drunk people. And so I think my socializing hasn't been what it could be. And I'm kind of okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the way Nicole and I have kind of approached it is we just limit it a lot. So we'll probably have a day or an evening where we drink once or twice a month. And one thing I really appreciate about my new coach this year is we were talking about how important it is to celebrate the victories.
Definitely.
Both literal and like figurative. And at some point I'd mentioned to him this fancy sour we had in our wine fridge at home. And he's like, dude, drink that bottle. When you get home, drink that bottle. I was like, okay. So we drank the bottle. But yeah, I mean, it's not to spend too much time dwelling on it, but it is really incredible how different we feel physically and mentally. And I'm not surprised you feel the same.
Yeah. And like, I haven't gone cold turkey, like out on the course. I had like half a beer, 'cause I was just like, that's going to taste really good right now. And I had like a tiny little shot at the, salsa SRAM, or Scratch Oasis. And I think that's okay. You know, life is all about moderation. So, as long as it doesn't overtake my life, I'm okay with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay. So, one thing that I wanted to touch on, well, actually, before we move on to the future, was there a moment out there during the Mid-South race where you had doubts about finishing or hit a low point?
Yes. Mile like 37, my body was hurting so bad. So I had recently gotten a bike fit and was pretty stoked to try it out. I'd been having knee issues even after surgery, and I don't know about you, but it takes me a long time to warm up on the bike and feel like my body is actually doing what it knows how to do. And so, like, you know, mile 20 to 30, I felt pretty good. And then mile 37, I was just like, what am I doing? You know, like everything hurts. And then I talk about this a lot, but Meg Fisher always says, if you're feeling sad or you're hurting, you just need to eat. And so I did. I had a snack, drank some water, popped some ibuprofen, and was like, I can do this. And so that was really the only time that doubt crept in. And then from there, I focused on...
So quite early.
Pretty early, yeah.
Yeah.
From then on, my body felt great. When I had my fit, the fitter, Ernie Lechuga, was really... He's an endurance... He's like a big name in ultra cycling. He was really encouraging me to focus on my core and my posture. You know, my fit was actually pretty decent, but just not being lazy on the bike. So as long as I like continued to readjust and focus on, you know, keeping my shoulders down and keeping my core tight, I felt really good.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's
great. Makes me excited for the rest of the season, because like this was such a good way to kick it off. And I was like real hesitant of like, am I going to blow myself up in this first like event of the season? And no, I'm actually going for a ride this afternoon. So.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So let's talk about the rest of the year. Because I don't remember who I heard it from, but I heard rumor of a big film or documentary of some kind. Can you talk about that yet?
Oh, yeah.
Like a bit in regards to Unbound?
Yeah.
So, well, I thought there was one in regards to Unbound.
That's what came out this week.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I missed that.
Well, it's easy to miss timing when you've got like a million articles about all these other things happening. So yeah, last year at Unbound, it was my first century, and I had a film crew with me from Pearl Izumi, and they made a real cute, it's like 10 minutes long. It's called Journey to Unbound, and it documents my day out there. And I will say Unbound was way harder than Mid-South. You know, the conditions, racing the time cutoff. And actually I was a lot faster at Unbound than I was at Mid-South. But I had to be because they do have that like strict time cutoff. But yeah, it's out on YouTube now, called Journey to Unbound. And there's some fun appearances. Ashton is in there. Thomas Decker makes an appearance, Brooke Gowdy. So it's just kind of a fun community celebration. Amazing. And I'm signed up for the 100 again at Unbound. We'll see.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. What your event goals look like for the rest of the year?
To stay healthy, protect my knee. You know, I thankfully don't get paid for my performance out there. So I'm not expected to go fast. But that means I got to take care of myself. You know, people are excited to see me. They're excited to do these community rides. So really just focusing on staying healthy, you know, being a representation and continuing to grow All Bodies on Bikes. So one big change I made this year is I'm no longer working with Chamois Butter, who puts on the most amazing shakedown rides. But I've stepped back from working with them and focused more on community rides instead. So folks who might not, you know, be at the events and don't feel comfortable going on a 12-mile shakeout ride. We're trying to do events adjacent to, or I say events, but basically a ride or a get together adjacent to the big event. But for folks in the community who maybe don't feel comfortable showing up to Mid-South, but they would feel comfortable going on a 3 or 4 mile slow casual ride.
That's awesome. Where will those be? Where and when will those be taking place this year? Where can folks get info?
Yeah. So the exact dates of all of them are not precise yet, but you can look for them at Steamboat Gravel, at Unbound, at Grounded Nebraska, basically all the big events. We're going to have an event at Ragbri this year. We're doing things with some mountain bike festivals. Yeah, so really kind of trying to diversify it up. I love gravel, but I also love road riding and mountain biking and just anytime I get to be on my bike.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome, Marley. You're doing so much good work. Well, where can people go check out that film that just came out this week? It's on YouTube, I assume?
It's on YouTube, called Journey to Unbound. I think we've got a link to it as well on my own Instagram and on the All Bodies on Bikes Instagram.
Awesome. Cool. Congrats again. And I will see you.
Congrats to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Sea Otter, I imagine you'll be at?
Yep. I will be at Sea Otter. Yep.
Cool. I'm sure we'll cross paths.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Have
good luck with the rest of your season.
Thank you. Have a good rest of your day. Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to today's Mid-South recap episode. We will do another for Sea Otter, but until then, we'll have a full month chock full of awesome long-form interview guests per usual. I want to say a big thank you to Marley and Carrie for coming on, giving us their time, and helping make this show fun and hopefully interesting. And I also want to say a huge thank you to all of you Mid-South participants who sent in your voice memos, your sound bites, shared with us some of your experience. I also want to say a big thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing the show. These recap episodes require extra time and effort for her. They're pretty complicated. Obviously, they have lots of different segments, so extra hours for her preparing these. And I want to thank all of you for listening, for your continued support of the podcast. If you would like to check out some video clips from the interview with Carrie or the interview with Marley, you can go to our Instagram, The Adventure Stash on Instagram, to check out some reels. Thank you all so much for listening, and we will catch you next week.